This is Joe Riggs and Leah Brown interviewing P.A. Harmon about the Slippery Rock University campus ministry and about his career as a campus minister on August 6, 1993. We'd like to start with an early disclosure, and that is that P.A. stands for Paul Ambrose, for those who don't know.
And it's also junior.
And it's also junior, and there is a Paul Ambrose III, who is now beginning his ministry.
Yes, so this is a very exciting time for our family. Last Sunday, he was called to be the pastor of a church, a United Church of Christ congregation in Bel Air, Ohio, which is a suburb across the river from Wheeling. So the 1st of September, he starts his time as a pastor there. So
that's my home country. I live just below Wheeling. So I know a little about Bel Air. I had a sister live there. The calling is large.
Yes.
A lot of sinners.
He just finished seminary in May. So we've had several months of kind of celebrations and then anticipation. And now another celebration coming up.
Well, I think we'd kind of like to begin at your beginning here, although you may want to say something about your earlier years in campus ministry. You now have a total of 20 years.
Yes, I've been a campus minister for 20 years, and the reason that I came to Slippery Rock in 1980 is because of the kind of ministry that they claimed at that point to be doing and wanting to be doing. I'm a product of the ecumenical movement. I went to seminary in 1965, from 1965 to 68. I was in graduate school at Emory University in Atlanta from 68 to 73, working in a doctoral program on American church history. So you might say I cut my theological teeth on that exciting time in the 60s, the ecumenical movement after the Second Vatican Council, all of the official and unofficial dialogues going on among various Christian groupings. Also involvement in civil rights movement at the time, feminist theology, part of my training in seminary, which was, I always will consider, a very important part of what makes me what I am at this point. Got involved in various social issues of anti-war movement, all of that sort of thing. And I know at this point it's fashionable to say we don't want to label people and we don't like to talk about labels, but I've always been very conscious of the fact, and I've worked very hard at being a liberal. And so I come out of a time in my church and theological training and involvement in social issues of the 60s, which are characterized in all kinds of different ways, but for me it was kind of the birthing of myself as a person and as a minister and as a campus minister. And I've always felt a calling to ministry in higher education, always, of course, from the time I started thinking about becoming a minister. And when I went to seminary, my idea was to go to seminary to get a master's divinity degree and then go to graduate school to get a PhD so that one day I could teach on college level, teach religion or philosophy. I felt a real calling into that. While I was at graduate school at Emory University, I came to the conclusion that I didn't really want to be teaching, but after making an acquaintance with some of the campus ministry people there, I came to realize that the two institutions that I loved the most, the church and the university, they came together at a special way every day in campus ministry. And so it was while I was a graduate student that I decided this is really what my calling is to be. And so I was one of those people that fairly easily, after having a pretty successful graduate career, decided before getting the PhD just to drop out. I mean, I had no qualms with doing that in the late 60s because a campus ministry position came open in Kentucky. So I went to Morehead State University in Kentucky, was there for 2 years, from 73 to 75. And from 75 to 1980, I was at Kearney State College in Nebraska. That was my first experience as an ecumenical campus minister there. It was supported by four different Protestant denominations. And then I started feeling a need to come back east to be closer to family and so forth. When I saw the position was open at Slippery Rock, and that my predecessor and the current Catholic campus minister were really serious about doing ministry together and trying to operate as a staff, I applied for this position with that in mind. This is a place that I want to go because they're doing the kind of ministry that I want to do. I had never been to Western Pennsylvania. I had no feeling for the place, or I wasn't drawn here by geography or anything else. But I was drawn here because of the unique aspect of the campus ministry as they advertised it when they were trying to hire a new pastor. And so I came here in 1980 with the intention of joining into an ecumenical ministry. And I found that exactly what I was looking for, because the Catholic campus minister at the time who was coming in also was new, Father Ted Rutkowski. And Ted had a vast ecumenical experience. He had been on the national body called National Institute for Campus Ministries. And so he had a lot of ecumenical experience. And we pledged together that when we came here, we would not only try to follow the example of our predecessors, but to expand it. At the same time, we were joined by a third person, a new person, a Sister Rosaire Kupchinski, who was just finishing up a master's program at Fordham in higher education. So the three of us came together within a month's time in August of 1980 from different parts of the country with all of us with the intention of doing ecumenical campus ministry. And Wilma Blake, who is currently the secretary at the Newman Center, also joined us that summer. She was Father Rutkowski's secretary in the diocesan office in Pittsburgh. So all of us came together, all of us knew, with the feeling of working together. And it was just a marvelous experience to come here knowing that something that I really wanted to do was actually, I was going to have a chance to do it. And so that was, when I arrived here in 1980, it was kind of the culmination, I think, of all that I had been trained to do out of the ecumenical movement. And one more word about the ministry here. It began in 1968. And they called a pastor, Neil Severance, who was a Presbyterian clergy person. And he was here until 1979, then took a position as dean of students at Rhode Island School of Design in Providence. And then I came the next year. So there have only been two campus ministers for the Protestant campus ministry since 1968, Neil Severance and myself. And the official title of our organization reflects, I think, the ecumenical movement in a way. Our official title is, and I always have to refer to some, United Christian Council for Campus Ministry at Slippery Rock, Pennsylvania. We've shortened it to United Campus Ministry, but the reason that it's significant is that it reflects one of the high points, I think, of the ecumenical movement. Because seven denominations decided in 68 to form United Ministries in Higher Education in Pennsylvania. And there the American Baptist Church, the Christian Church, Disciples of Christ, Church of the Brethren, the Episcopal Church, the Presbyterian Church, USA, the United Church of Christ, and the United Methodist Church. And Pennsylvania is the very last state that still has one of these ecumenical organizations with a full-time director. Many other states have similar organizations with various configurations of mostly mainline Protestant churches that went together. And Pennsylvania has always led the way in ecumenical campus ministry. So the ministry that I became a part of was not only ecumenical on the Protestant level, but then when I came here and joined in with the Roman Catholic staff and moved into the Newman Center, although I've never been officially part of the Newman Center, I moved in and had an office there, and we tried to do all of our programming together. And we intentionally worked as a staff which makes it very interesting when you're not a staff and you try to work like one. It, it's both positive and negative. In some ways, the negative is you don't have the kind of support structure that a staff has. But on the positive side, if you decide to do it and work at it, then it becomes even stronger in many ways because you're doing it because you want to. So that you might say the ecumenical movement and my calling into higher education, ministry in higher education, is what brought me to Slippery Rock, and I've just completed my 13th year.
Has the L word caused you any problems over those years? That so many people just don't call themselves liberals very much because they have a kind of a clientele or a group to serve that doesn't like the word.
No, it hasn't given me any trouble, I don't think, because, you know, we need some folks around who call themselves certain things, and I think to act at times like a lightning rod. I think sometimes you're a lightning rod and sometimes you're a seismograph, but I think what I mean by calling myself a liberal is that I come out of a tradition that has called me to be open not only to persons, but persons of all faith traditions, persons of ethnic and racial traditions, persons who don't think like I do. I was trained to see that as a positive rather than a negative. And that as part of what I consider as being a liberal, an openness rather than a sectarian person, a closed person, an open person. And the other part, I think, of being a, quote, liberal is to see where one can, from a person of a faith tradition, where does my faith tradition impact what I really do and where I live and the social conditions around me? And I think that seeing persons in situations, seeing that it's the situation that makes the difference, not some guidelines or standards from which I can never deviate or whatever. But a person of faith in the Judeo-Christian tradition, it seems to me, is a person who sees God at work in the world, and my place is to join in where God is at work. I'll tell you two brief illustrations. One, not long after I came here, two students came to see me who had watched me from sort of afar for a bit. And they came to see me and they were very concerned that they didn't think that I was being what they considered a good Christian campus minister. And what they said to me was, one of the people said to me, "We don't believe that you are taking God to this campus the way you ought to be doing." And I said, "That is not my job, to take God to this campus. My job is to find out where God is at work on this campus and in the community and join in." And very often I'm surprised and even shocked at where I find God at work. It might not be with folks that I ordinarily associate with or in situations that I'm comfortable with, but that is what I think it means to be sensitive to and open to where God is at work. And I think if you approach ministry like that, you're less likely to come off as someone who arrives on the scene with all of the answers, and you're probably less likely to beat someone over the head with your own tradition rather than you know helping persons through your tradition. And the other situation was the very first year that I was in campus ministry in Kentucky, and that goes back to my calling myself a liberal. A chemistry professor there asked me to come by to see him one day, and so not long after I'd been there. And so we were chatting. He was telling me about his philosophy of life and his politics, and it became very clear after a while. He was also telling me what he expected as a Methodist, and I was called there as a Methodist campus minister. What he was expecting of me there. And he ended our conversation by saying, "I'm a conservative. I work hard every day at being a conservative because I know that there are liberals and radicals out there trying to change my way of life. They're attacking everything about what I know it means to be an American and a Christian and a Southerner. And he went on and on and on. And as I left his office and going down the steps, I remember saying to myself, I am a liberal. And I'm going to work hard every day at being a liberal because I know that there are conservatives out there, like the gentleman I just spoke to, who are so afraid of their, you know, losing their status in life or whatever, that it gets in the way. It really does get in the way of serving others. And it gets in the way of being open to God's leading and God's spirit. Now, I know that in my liberality, I can become just as close, you know, I can become just as dogmatic about that as I can as any other. So I'm not criticizing folks who call themselves conservatives, because in many ways I think I'm a conservative in some ways too, in worship and other kinds of ways. You're not going to find anybody more wanting to conserve the tradition than I do, or wanting to conserve whatever. So although those terms do get mixed up and we do have to be careful about what we call each other, but I try not to call anybody else labels, but I am very conscious that what I want to be and what I want to do as a minister falls into what I would define as a liberal position.
And when you can talk about it that way, it reduces polarity enormously, you know, when you can describe and define what it is your liberalism is all about.
Yes.
Because many of the conservatives will kind of come full circle and say, well, gee, that's where I am as well.
That's,
you know,
right. Yeah. One of the things that I think that we found that it is important in a dialogic kind of way to be able to talk about how are we different and how that can be seen not as something that as a negative, but as something as a positive. How, you know, isn't it wonderful that we are different? That's why when we start to talk about racial issues, in the last several years, my ministry has been very much defined by involvement with minority students, and I'll talk about at great length, if you want me to sometime, the group that was originated here in after a cross-burning incident in 1990 called START, Students Together, Alleviating Racial Tensions. But I have always felt that when we start using colorblind statements, or we start using descriptive statements of each other that don't take into account who we really are. For instance, when I look at a person of color, it's a very important part of who they are. I don't think it's a good idea to start using colorblind language. When I'm relating to another person, their ethnic, cultural, religious, racial, whatever makeup, background, to me is an extremely important part of who they are, and it should be celebrated and acknowledged. And when I, especially a person who's of the majority, when I start using colorblind, all that says, when I start using colorblind language, all that really says is that I want you to be like me. And being a white, male, heterosexual, blue-eyed, blonde-haired, Southern clergy, I have never been discriminated against. There is never a time when I can't walk into any room and I don't have to worry. I have two small glitches in my life. One, I'm a Southerner. One, I'm a minister. And I am very much aware over the years of being stereotyped in those ways. But that's okay, and it's very minor, and it's no big deal. But what I have found in trying to relate to international students, minority persons, and persons from all religious traditions, is that we really do need to celebrate and acknowledge each other's differences. And I think that has been a defining part of what it has meant to be me to be a minister in the world of higher education. Because there's very few places left anymore like the academic world, where we have the opportunity to celebrate diversity, but also to celebrate our unity, where we are alike and where we are different. Also, the university is one of the last places where at least we say should be a place, a marketplace of ideas, all of those kinds of terms of free-flowing intellectual conversation. Now, we all know that there are all kinds of limits on that with political and other reasons. But at least here we say out loud that this is what we ought to be doing. That's why I think that ministry in higher education for me has been so exciting and fulfilling. And I can't imagine ever doing anything else. Because all of the students now, who 20 years ago when I was their campus minister, and now they're calling me on the phone and talking to me about their children who are getting ready to go to college, and about some of the moments that we had together that I don't even remember anymore, conversations that we had that they say were turning points in their life, because I listened to them and joined in their questioning rather than piling answers on top of them. That just tells me over and over again that it is in the world of higher education where, as a minister, I have a great opportunity not only to grow spiritually myself, but to help other people grow. It's wonderful to talk to former students, and I'm sure that you share that with me, to talk to former students who have had a significantly positive experience that you were somehow a part of, or maybe you weren't a part of it, but you saw them, you know, come in a place like Slippery Rock, where I have seen students come in under the University Enrichment Program who probably wouldn't have had a chance anywhere else. And I'm right now thinking of several examples. They just blossomed, you know, and they became what we all would just hope that education can help people do. And so a place like Slippery Rock that gives people a chance, or any place in higher education that gives people a chance to grow and flourish, if that's been part of what it is meant to be, me to be, in ministry in higher education. I have a T-shirt that says John Wesley was a campus minister. John Wesley, of course, was one of the founders of the Methodist Church, of which I am a part. The Methodist Church really started on Oxford University's campus with John Wesley, an Anglican priest, and his brother and others who felt a need for, you know, spiritual renewal and that sort of thing. So I'm always hearkening back to the fact that the church has not only always been a very important part of higher education, but the reason that they have sent me here is that not to convert folks on this campus to Christianity, or not to make little Methodist out of little something else, but to celebrate the world of higher education, saying we believe that higher education is an important gift of God, and we want to celebrate it with you. I've always seen campus ministry as having two facets. One is the personal facet, in which you relate to individuals, you relate to persons, either in times of celebration or in crisis, times of inquiry. The other facet, and perhaps the most important facet to me, is the systemic part of what I do. By that I mean I consciously, self-consciously relate to Slippery Rock University as an institution, as a system, made up of faculty, administrators, and students who are together, you know, in a time of inquiry. And so we've always used in Slippery Rock, the Protestant campus ministry folks have always used words like ministry of presence and involvement. And we use the word that came out of the 1960s also for campus ministry called prophetic inquiry. Being involved in, actively involved in the academic world with whatever is happening with it, within the inquiring into the learning process, and being ready to make our contribution from our tradition, but more importantly to join in that process of inquiry. And campus ministry has allowed me to do that.
Is there a difference between being a member of the campus ministry and being a a classroom teacher in terms of how open you can be about what you believe, think, and feel? Are there more constraints on ordinary faculty than there are on someone in the campus ministry?
Well, one of the things that I've always very much appreciated about being a campus minister at a state-related, state-owned, or whatever institution, is that I am not officially connected to the university. And although I am officially still connected to my church, I am sort of in between. I fall somewhere on the periphery or the edge of both of those institutions. And therefore, I obviously have felt a great amount of freedom to take part in the academic life, to be critical if I needed to be, to ask questions that I thought needed to be asked, and to be told by my church also that this is what we expect. We expect you to be a minister there. Every campus is different, and every place has to, you have to respond, you know, differently. So I am sure, I've never been a faculty member, but I am sure that there is a difference. I speak in classes often enough, and I know that I've been asked by several faculty members to talk to class about diversity, for instance, or whatever, and indicating to me that maybe I could say some things that they could say, and they wouldn't have any problem saying them, but later on they wouldn't have to deal with ramifications of all that. So I think it is. There certainly has been a feeling of that I have been asked to contribute and have been accepted. You see, I think there's a great responsibility with that, though, because there are no official kind of restraints, and there are no sanctions that this university could put against me or whatever. So I take that very seriously, that if I get involved and if I say what I believe, or if I make some kind of a position statement or a prophetic statement to the university, that it's done in a very careful and loving way. And my style has always been not to be so confrontational, but to go to persons and talk. And I've had a very close relationship with our current president, Bob Ebersole. I've considered him both a friend and colleague, but we both know that whenever we really want to say to each other what we need to say for the good of the institution, we can do that, and we do. And it's done in private, but I felt a real a sense not only of trust, but also of working as a colleague with Bob and nearly everybody else at Slippery Rock. I have found the university, one of the things that we're finding in the church these days, that the university is still one of those places that welcome us. And I have hardly any, I don't have to jump over hurdles, fight battles or whatever around here to be involved on this campus. Now, some of that has to do with my predecessor, Neil Severance, you know, establishing for the first 12 years of this ministry a trust relationship. And I followed him, people here expecting me to be like him in many ways. And after a few years, proving that I could be trusted. So there has never been a feeling on my part of having to break down walls of resistance or whatever. I've always been involved since the very first day. As a matter of fact, not long ago, I was going through some files from 1980, and I was part of what they called in 1980 the fall welcome days for students. I hadn't been here but a month, but in September I was leading small groups at the bequest of the administration with students coming in. I think what that told me right away was that we want you here, and we appreciate you being here. And I've tried to work around here as if people might think that I was part of the staff. I mean, I That's part of what I mean by the systemic part of the ministry. For instance, I have been a part of the Employee Wellness Committee since its beginnings. And I've been a part of the Gerontology Committee for probably 10 years. And various other groups that I have been a part of, but those are faculty administrative level committees that I have taken full part in. I didn't need to be part of any of those. Nobody asked me to or expected me to, but as part of what I felt and my local board felt was part of campus ministry, was to be involved there in being helpful. And we recently had an on-site evaluation. Team of people came to evaluate the ministry, and the last conversation they had was with the president, and he said some very kind things, but the most important thing I think that he said was that it would cost the university something to hire somebody to do what I do, and it's free for the university. So and that to me is, you know, that's exactly what I would hope that he would feel, because that is what, without any expectations, without wanting anything from the university except acceptance, and that's all that I've received here, and it's been very positive. I feel that I'm very much a part of a team of people on this campus who really care about the community, the students and faculty and administrators, people in health services. I see that, you know, there are all kinds of opportunities for me to get involved. I have never thought about campus ministry as, quote, student work. Obviously, with 7,000 plus students around here, that's the main component of what this university is. But I've always seen campus ministry as ministry in higher education, and I've seen my involvement with faculty and administrators and other support staff just as important as working with students. Now, there have been occasions when people who pay for this, who are out there in the churches, have a question about that, because usually when somebody asks me how things are going, they want to know, how many kids do you have in your group? Well, it gives me an opportunity to do a bit of my own sort of education. First of all, I don't call university students kids. I mean, I do slip up occasionally, but I feel if you want somebody to act like an adult, you start treating them like an adult, and your language is the first part of that. Secondly, I don't have a group. I have intentionally not formed a group of people who would say we are P.A. Harmon's group or the campus ministry's group. I relate to a lot of groups, and I relate to students on all kinds of levels. When they want to talk about how I relate to students, many people have an idea that a campus minister is someone who comes to campus to sort of take care of the students that they send, and sort of keep them on the straight and narrow, or keep them involved in the church and make sure that they come through this place unscathed and funneled back out to the churches, you know, not having been influenced by the evil world out there. Well, I don't see that in any way as part of my calling, except obviously in situations somebody needs that, they certainly have that. But I try to relate. I've often told people, you know, I'm your campus minister, whether you like it or not. You know, I believe and I feel that I am in many ways the pastor for everyone here. And I would hope, I don't mean that in any kind of an arrogant way, but I mean it in a way that no one who lives, works, or plays at this institution is someone that I would not want to be involved with in any way if I can be helpful or to help celebrate their life with them. And my local board has always been very supportive of that and has never never asked me questions like, you know, what are the numbers for these kind of things. But are you involved in the ministry of presence on this campus, and are you relating to the university and responding where you think the response needs to be?
Is that a kind of outline of the guidelines from your board? What do you have made your presence, you know, very felt and very important? And so you have a lot of freedom, or you've assumed a lot of freedom on this campus. And is that what your board wants of you? What other guidelines have they put down for you?
Yes, we have always assumed, and when I say we, my local board, and perhaps I need to talk about the local board in a minute, since I've referred to them several times, and that's a term that I've introduced to you. But yes, we have felt all along, since I've been here, that we need to provide, as a campus ministry on this campus, almost everything that a local parish would provide in a local congregation, knowing that this is not a local congregation, knowing that it's different. But for instance, when I make annual reports, we make them under the following headings, generally speaking, it changes a bit each year, but I've always tried to provide worship experiences for students. That means, on the one hand, every Thursday night I celebrate Holy Communion in the chapel at the Newman Center for anybody who wants to come. I also try to make it possible for students from every religious tradition to relate to their worshiping community. Every summer, when we get the religious affiliation cards, we go through those and disseminate that information to all the Christian and Jewish other organizations in the community, so they can contact their students to let them know about worship experiences. So I take it very seriously that one of the things that I need to be doing here is to provide for, in the broadest sense, worship opportunities for students and faculty and others. Secondly, try to provide for education. By that I mean, in the broadest sense of the word, historical and religious educational opportunities. The example of that, and I think it's a very positive example, is the lecture series at the Newman Center. Father Rutkowski and I started that in the fall of 1980. And every semester since then, that must be 26 semesters or so, we have had a lecture series that's been open to the community, not only to faculty and students, but to everybody in the community. And we've tried to cover the widest variety of topics, all the way from church history to world religions to social issues. And so we intentionally do a lecture series, and we don't try to be cute by that and calling it, you know, serendipity or come by and share your stuff with us. We call it a lecture series because we lecture. That's one of the things folks are accustomed to doing on campus. And I think sometimes people who are in campus ministry think they need to be cute or innovative or whatever to draw people in. Well, we decided that what we need to be is intellectually rigorous and honest and work hard at what we do. So when you come to one of our lecture series, I hope that you come with the expectation that I will have done my homework and that if this is approaching at least a college level lecture. So we do those kinds of things. So worship and education, fellowship. I'm very conscious of providing for, either, for instance, at the Newman Center through parties and dances and different kinds of fellowship and social activities, or through local congregations, to make sure that students who want to be involved with fellowship things related to their own religious tradition can do that. Also, service. We try to provide through our Senior Citizens Assistance Program that we also started in 1980, provide opportunities for students and others to relate to the community through helping senior citizens with all kinds of tasks and chores around their home, to visiting nursing homes, to being involved. We have come to the point over the last several years of providing a way for people in for instance, social work classes send their students to us in campus ministry to relate them to our programs in the two nursing homes in the community, the high rise for the elderly here in town, and in other kinds of opportunities. So worship, education, fellowship, and service are kind of the four things that if you ask any parish, Christian or any other tradition, what are the kind of things that you do here? Those are the things that you would say. So I have always taken that as the, that at least I want to help people get involved with those kinds of activities. And then what I do then as a pastor opens up all of those areas of presence, involvement on campus and relating to faculty members. I do something that somebody started using the term, I think it was in the health services after about my third year here. I walked into the office there in Claire Schmieler's office, and somebody said, "Hey, you know, what are you doing?" And she said, "He's making rounds," and which is a medical kind of term, but it struck me that's exactly what I was doing. I intentionally make rounds. I am in every academic building on this campus every week, and I there are places that I intentionally make sure that I visit all the time, for no other reason, just to say hello, but that inevitably has opened up opportunities for involvement in various kinds of ways. And so, on the one hand, we have some fairly self-conscious guidelines for a campus ministry, but then on the other hand, it's sort of like whatever the person who's here. It's interesting that over the last couple of years, we've had some serious financial problems, and so if you look at my budget, I spend about $200 a year on programs. Mostly I do that because I don't have more money, but I don't know if I had much more, if I would spend much more, because in a way, my personality and my approach has come to the point where I am pretty much the program. I mean, whatever, I can use other people's money. I can use other people's facility. I can join in with other groups doing things, but primarily the ministry here is seen very much as centered in the campus minister and what he or she would get involved with. We are related to United Ministries in Higher Education in Pennsylvania, which supports us through block grants. All of those seven denominations I mentioned earlier give money to United Ministries in Higher Education in Pennsylvania. And we have at the moment, counting full-time and part-time ministries, about 20 to 22 ministries in Pennsylvania, mostly related to the Sheehy campuses. And so we are related to them in a way of accountability, reporting, and that sort of thing. But at each local level, a local board oversees the work of the campus ministry. And the local board here is made up of pastors from the churches, the congregations, who are part of United Ministries in Higher Education, a couple of laypersons from their congregation, and then a category that I love, the at-large category, which means whomever we want to get to be related to our board. And over the years, some of the early people on our board are some retired persons, some of them are still around. Carl Lochner, who a former faculty member at Slippery Rock, was an early member of the board. Pastor John Peterson of the Center Presbyterian Church is probably the earliest member of a person who was interested in getting this ministry started. So he's been a member of the board for however many, 25, 26 years that we've been in existence. Carl Dresden, who is still a faculty member here, he was early involved. Jan Hudak, who retired a couple of years ago, was a member. Some of the current members, Tom Gaither, Joe Lisandro, Ann Dayton, Claire Schmieler, which, just to stop there for a moment, Claire is a Roman Catholic, but is a member of the Protestant Campus Ministry Board, simply because she was seen as an important, you know, important part of this community to make contributions to our board. It is nice that she is a Roman Catholic, which adds a bit of diversity to our board. But our board is very diverse anyway in their own thinking and their own theology and their own approach to ministry. But these are the persons that, who oversee my ministry. So as you can clearly see, a lot of them, I see them every day anyway. So we work very closely together. They're my pastors, they're my support system, they're my friends, because this could become a rather lonely kind of position, because the next colleague, the next Protestant campus minister that I would relate to would be in Pittsburgh or Clarion or wherever. So I really appreciate the friendship and support that I've gotten from the members of the board. And so the board has been fairly constant over the years. It has been, when it needs to be involved, actively it is. When I leave one day, they'll become very active because they will have to hire somebody. They'll go through the process of doing a nationwide search and filtering that, like every other, you know, board or department has to go through. But they are involved. Right now, they're pretty much involved because we are having financial problems. It's interesting that the history of campus ministry has really followed the history of the ecumenical movement. When the ecumenical movement was in its height in the late 60s and everybody was excited about Christian unity and we're talking to everybody, even non-Christian, we were doing all this sort of thing, money was flowing into all of these kinds of things. Now, what I do is very low on the priority list of all the denominations that support me. Not because they don't think it's important on the one hand, but everybody's having financial problems. So My title, what I do is so ecumenical that it's easy for them to cut their contributions to us. So now that the ecumenical movement has sort of fallen on hard times, so have ecumenical campus ministries. But that's, to me, on the one hand, it is disappointing and upsetting that in my 53rd year I need to be worried about whether I'm going to be paid next week. But on the other hand, it also provides for some exciting new ways of rethinking and some innovation, because we've always been innovative, I think, in campus ministry. We've always been encouraged to be different, to do things differently, to see things and to try things in new ways. And maybe this, at this point, because we're running out of money, we're going to be forced again to say, what is it going to look like now? It just can't go on the way it was. And the liberal in me will get to say, all right, let's be open to, let's experiment with and try some things, even though structures or traditions say that's not the way, perhaps, that it's done. But my 13 years at Slippery Rock has shown me that although things seemingly haven't changed very much, that under the surface there have been kind of major changes that cause us to have to look at what everything that we do in new and different ways. And right now the financial situation is causing us to look at different configurations. So it could be next year or 10 years from now there won't be a full-time person in my position. There might be a part-time person related to all the local congregations or any kind of different configurations.
How does the fundraising work? Each of these supporting units commits through their annual budget?
Yes.
And is the local board involved in fundraising also?
When I came here, 99% of our budget came from the block grant from United Ministries of Higher Education. At the moment, we are involved in a full-blown fundraising effort of the local board. When I came here, it was never the case that we ask a local congregation for contributions or an individual. But now that is very much a part of what we do, because we're having to ask now congregations and generally the Slippery Rock area where we would draw students from to consider putting us in their budget, the local congregations and individuals. We've asked individuals. Now, I'm not very good at this, and I don't feel very comfortable about it, and I don't want to do it. And so I'm doing it, and they're sort of dragging me in, kicking and screaming, but I'm doing it. Obviously, I need to do it. But so my local board now is, they're not preoccupied with this, but it has become the sort of the major item of our meetings. When we get together, they say, how are things going, and whatever, and we chat about that for a while, but then they say, now, how are we going to keep this going? And so it's wide open now as to fundraising. Foundations very often have money, but they have money to support programs. And right now what we need is money to pay my salary and my pension plan and all of those goodies. So foundations are not a very, an obvious way to raise money right now. So I think what it means for the future is it's going to be different. And things are going to have to change because I don't see in a way possible for a return to those good old days of the high point of the ecumenical movement when all these folks are contributing money for this kind of thing.
Can you tell us about one or several campus crises that were involved in and helped to find perhaps solutions for something we ought to remember?
Well, to me, at this point, the most obvious one is the beginning of the group called START. START stands for Students Together Alleviating Racial Tensions. And in February of 1990, we had a cross-burning incident at the Keister Apartments. Within 24 hours, the two students who were involved with burning the cross were gone, removed from the community. But obviously, this brought home to people in a way that hardly anything else can, that there's a major racial crisis in our midst. And what do we do? I've been a member of the President's Commission on Race Relations ever since he started that several years ago. The next day, we met in kind of emergency session, bringing all kinds of people together to say, how do we address this situation? Not only the present situation about the cross burning and how do we deal with the hurt that caused, but how do we go on from there and do some other things? So we came up with all kinds of different programs and plans. And I mentioned in the meeting that I thought there was one thing missing that we hadn't dealt with yet, and that was to form a student organization that would get together with the sole purpose of talking to each other about racism. And if it broadened out from there, okay, but we need to get a group of students together because, as I mentioned earlier, a significant part of my education occurred during the 1960s, and I was really a part of movements that where we knew that if students got involved, we were empowered and we had power to bring changes in the community. We could actually change things the way people did things. So I asked that a student group be formed and that I be allowed to meet with them for a while to get them going, but that no faculty or administrators be a part of it, and that it not be a formal structure, that it be a gathering of students to talk about racism. Well, they said, of course, do that. So we decided we would call a meeting for that very week, and we decided, are there students that we know who would be good to start this group, rather than just saying volunteers? So we came up with 16 names, and the president had a breakfast for us within the week after this cross-burning incident, and we met. We decided that we would meet in Boozle Dining Hall in their back room, the dining hall there, private dining room, on a weekly basis for dinner. And we started meeting that week, the next week, at 4 o'clock on on Monday in Boozle. And that group met without missing a meeting for 2 solid years, except we missed a couple of meetings during the summer. But within a couple of weeks, they decided to take the name START, and that we would talk about anything under the sun, but you know, centering in on racism, and that we would do some programming and so forth. It's been the single most exciting group that I've ever been a part of. There's any question about it. We ended up with a wonderful mix of African Americans, white, Hispanic, Asian, a real cross-section of religious traditions. And one of the most important program that we came up with the first year came out of a Jewish student making a comment to an African American student. The comment was, he said, we'd got to the point where we were really being honest with each other. And we can say anything we want to in this room and treat it like, you know, gently and with love. He said to the black student, whenever I see you, I think Christianity. All of your great leaders in the 20th century have been Christian. And he said, I have been here for 4 years now, and I've never been able to spend Passover with my family. And he said, I just want you to know that that bothers me, that I have always had to live my life under the Christian calendar, and at times I feel that oppresses me. Well, now, this is not a conversation they would have had, you know, having coffee somewhere, but in this setting, where he brought that up, he said, you know, this might not be something you think about very often. And the black student said, you know, he was just astounded. He said, I had never thought about that. And, well, what can we do? Is there anything that we can do to help? And the student said, you know, if you weren't able to spend family with your family for Easter next year, would there be protests to the president? And yes, and all this sort of thing. So we said, well, why don't we put together a calendar and publish it in the Rocket and list every religious holiday that we can get our hands on every month, all the national holidays around the world. And I said, also, I've got a calendar at home that lists women's birthdays of every day of the year. So the more we thought about this, the more excited we got, and we started publishing the START calendar that comes out in the Rocket. And it's called START October with whatever. And we had such wonderful response from that calendar from people all over campus who would come up to us and say, I have learned so much from just looking at this calendar. Or somebody would call up and say, you spelled Czechoslovakia wrong. Or they would say, I'm Hindu, and that's not what this holy day is really all about. Of course, you know, Christians and Jews and anybody can argue about exactly what this holy day is about. But it was so educational for people. Even when we made a mistake in the calendar, they would obviously know we didn't mean it. And it was such an educational thing. So that group was meeting, it became a self-sustaining kind of a thing. The students got so excited about what they could do, the kind of changes they could make in their own life, their own ability to confront racism or sexism in settings where they were, or any kind of bigotry in various settings. And we asked Dr. Faust if he would let us have an orientation session with new faculty for the next year, tenure track faculty who were coming in, and he said, sure. And the students put together a presentation that was sort of titled, this is what it's like to be a minority person or a woman in your class. And they did a little skit. And then we ate together with these people and they talked about this. And the students did it all themselves, and I just sat there and marveled at how they were able to relate to the faculty, and the faculty opened up to them about, you know, this is what we feel like. When you assume, you know, the majority cultural position and all that sort of thing. Now, we were also invited to go into residence halls and other kinds of things. But through that situation, through that group, resulting from a crisis, we were able to, I think, touch quite a few people. We also made a national newsletter of a group. The name of the group slips my mind. Accuracy in Academia. Have you heard of that? Accuracy in Academia is a group that was put together about 5 years ago to watch in the world of academics for any liberal or radical notions. And we published some things that got into the hands of Accuracy in Academia in Erie. And we made their newsletter, START Group at Slippery Rock University. Their literature is causing racial tensions rather than easing them, kind of things. So that was almost as good as being on Richard Nixon's enemies list. You know, we knew that we had arrived. And the word got around through various of our networks that higher education has. And we were able to help people on different campuses around the country get their own groups going. I had calls from people in UCLA and Fairmont State and North Dakota State, a student in University of Maine, Presque Isle campus, and at least a half a dozen others that I can't remember exactly now, who we were able to encourage them to start their own group. And there were students, as a matter of fact, the young man who confronted the African-American student about the calendar, he went off to work in Western Illinois University from here in student affairs. And he came back the next year and we had lunch together. And he said that was probably one of the most important groups in his whole life. And the next thing on his agenda out there after he got his job settled was to get a group going like that. Because what he was able to learn from just being open and honest with other people and having that forum, it was just immeasurable. And over the 2 years, probably no more than 60 to 70 students actually took part in the START meetings. They were able to, I think, impact people in all kinds of areas of their life. I know a student right now who's going to begin his student, he did his student teaching this past year, but will be a teacher this year, said that because he was part of that group, he now is more able to relate to fifth graders and to help them deal with racial issues and sexism and what it really means to be a majority person as he is. So I could probably spend the rest of our time talking about START. Clearly that has been a very important group for me, and I think it's what I'm really interested to see is how the group will be formed again this coming year, because almost everybody who was in the original group is gone now. We are going to still be meeting. We're going to be meeting in the Cultural Center every other Tuesday night. And as far as I'm concerned, it's a brand new group. Whatever the group wants to do, we'll do. We have resisted all of this time organizing. They're still not an organized group within the student government and haven't asked for funding. We've resisted all of those things that the organizations get into. So we're still sort of this freewheeling group, and they haven't kicked me out yet, so I'm going to keep on meeting with them. But we'll see what that's going to be doing. There are other instances that over the years that have kind of, obviously when there's a tragedy on campus, we've had, since I've been here, we've had a murder-suicide, we've had suicides, we've had all kinds of tragic deaths and automobile accidents and sudden illnesses and deaths. One of the things that I think that we were able to do fairly very much interested in being involved in the appropriate way when something, some tragedy or whatever took place, that we wouldn't automatically assume that we would do a memorial service or that we were the ones to step in as, we're not the chaplains of the university. But we wanted them to know that however they saw us taking part. So we came up with a set of guidelines that when there's a death on campus or a tragedy of some kind, immediately certain people get notified and they're related to us, and to help to do memorial services. So over the years, I think being involved with memorial services and grief counseling has been very positive thing for us, a way that we can be helpful to the campus, even though faculty, and if this were a private university, there would be a chaplain whose duty it would be to do all of those things. But I think over the years we have been able to operate as chaplains in that setting. Those are the things that come to mind that I think that we've been able to get involved with and make some significant changes, differences.
Have you, when students have had academic problems and have run into some intransigence from an office or faculty members, and you feel sure that there's an injustice involved there, do you intercede from time to time in those kinds of matters?
Yes. There are all kinds of ways to do that. One is to help that student figure out how he or she can take the next step on their own, or relating them to some other persons. And in the end, if they need just another presence with them, or they need me to talk to the person, I will do that. I think on the one hand, I'm very conscious of trying to preserve that student's independence and their own integrity, helping them feel that they can solve problem themselves. But it's obvious, those of us who have been around longer, than it's obvious that, you know, that when you know somebody that you can have their ear, it does help. So I think that, to me, that's a very important thing that we've done over the years.
And you feel good about being able to do that without creating.
Yes, I feel good about it even when it has created the problem, or even when I was told, you know.
Even when you lose.
Yes, because, you know, that the point is that, you know, one of the things that I've become accustomed to, and I hardly ever think about it anymore in campus ministry, is almost like a major league batting average. You know, I expect to fail 70% of the time, and I'm going to have a good day. By that I mean ideas that I have, programs that I think are great and everybody ought to flock to them, or changes that I see ought to be made, or whatever. I don't see that, you know, those things that don't work. To me, that's just part of what it means to do what I do. And I have always been, I'm not an extrovert. I have to work very hard at those extrovert things. You know, I'd rather be just by myself, sitting in the stacks thinking and talking to one other person all the time. So I've had to work really hard. I've chosen a profession in which, you know, extroversion is rewarded, and introversion is sort of seen as you're either aloof or shy or whatever. So I've had to work really hard at those things. So I think maybe that's made me, you know, a little better at that, because I have learned how, I think, to come on as a kind of confrontational way, but in an honest way of saying, you know, this is something that needs to be addressed. And the things that I've had to work the hardest at over my life are the things that I think are most rewarding. For instance, at this very moment, I'm working at one of the most difficult things is that I've always had a stuttering problem from the time I can remember. And when I was a teenager, I could hardly put a sentence together. I would never talk on the telephone. Recently, I went back to my home congregation to celebrate its 150th anniversary, and I was the guest preacher, of course. Well, an elderly man came up to me, just tears streaming down his face, saying, "I can't believe what I just heard. You know, I haven't seen you in all these years." Whatever. So I tell you that story because it is very much a part of what it means to be who I am and what I do, is that I have to work very hard all the time at not stuttering. And so a handicapping kind of condition, which is, it's a mild one, but compared to what a lot of people have to go through. But I think that having to deal with something like that heightens your awareness and sensitivity to others, and to know that you can really take charge of things. You can do some things. So that I don't very often share that with people, but it seemed to kind of appropriate here.
Well, kind of every little town in America, when I grew up, had a stutterer or two or three or more, and they were always treated as very, very different and mentally deficient, and all kinds of bad things happen to stutterers. The other part of that is that if you have a handicap and you have to come through that situation, then somehow you come out on the other end a little stronger.
Well, it never, you know, you always are aware of it, but it has been, like I say, it's turned out to be a positive part of my life anyway.
You talked about the difficulty with that terrible incident of the cross burning and a very positive way that the campus and you handled that, and you got something good going. Were there other instances where groups of students sought you out to help resolve problems? Are there things like that you can share with us? Any major issues?
Well, in 1968, when I went to Emory University and saw myself as really involved in civil rights movement and all that sort of thing, I realized that I had never been involved with the gay community in any kind of way except in a curious kind of way. So I started attending a gay support group there. And from that point on, I have felt a closeness to gay community wherever I've gone. And early on while I was here, a faculty member and a couple of students and I were talking about the situation here with gay and lesbian persons. And so we formed an organization that met in my office for a few years and then moved out of there onto campus, and is now, through a couple of name changes, has become an official part of the university under the auspices of the Office of Minority Affairs, Dwight Greer's office. I think they've even changed the office from Office of Minority Affairs and Cultural Diversity. Now the group right now is called ALU, Alternative Lifestyles Union. I don't approve of their name, but anyway, I very much approve of their group. So that is early, probably in 81 or 82, I became actively involved in helping gay and lesbian students on the campus to do whatever they needed for support, just to get together and talk. That is primarily what we did over the years, to talk about their own situation, to say, what do we need to do with education? How do we live in this kind of a setting in this society? So that's one group that, in a way, sought me out, but I was looking at the same time to be related to that group. There have also been groups of students that have turned out to be sort of ongoing things of people that, after a while, I spoke in Alan Larson's class on world religions, I came in to talk about, he asked me to do a history of Christianity one night. So, you know, I did it one evening, of course. Well, out of that, several students came by and said they'd like to continue the conversation. And I remember that as being a memorable 6 or 8 week conversation with them. Several other times, after having either related to students in various groups or settings or classrooms, other groups have gotten together with me over kind of a medium period of time, 6 to 8 weeks or a whole semester sometime, to pursue conversations about. I know one group got together to really talk about what does it mean to be part of the peace movement in the 80s? Now, in the 80s, peace movements, they weren't cropping up on every corner, but there were always students around saying, you know, we don't like the belligerent attitude of our country or other countries, what do we do about this? And so along with Ted Knoiper, formed a group called Citizens for World Peace. I mean, that's a kind of a, we weren't very, we didn't have a problem with ego there, Citizens for World Peace. So for 3 or 4 years, that group really, I think, did some significant things too, involving students in conversations. There have been different times when mostly small groups of students have come to me to talk about different areas, but those are the ones that stand out. I have always been very close to and feeling with international students, and for the last several years, Jim Merhut, who's the lay Catholic campus minister at the Newman Center, and I have been the advisors to the Internations Club, and so we do all kinds of things with them. But I've always felt a closeness to minority students and international students, and been really drawn to people who either are on the fringes of things, and so that has been another over the years. Various, once in a while we'll talk with students from Africa about some issues. The Newman Center in 1982 and 83, I believe, was put out a newspaper. It was an occasional paper called Voices of the Third World. It only lasted about 6 editions because, you know, after a while people had written all they were going to write and they got tired of it. And as you know, on campuses, things are really cyclothymic. Every other semester it's a new world for some people. But Voices of the Third World came to be a group of people, mostly from Africa, but from other third world countries, and to talk about, they wrote articles about their country, about their issues that they saw that ought to be dealt with here while they're here. And that was a really important group. So the groupings that have come out of those kind of settings have been really important. That's really all that comes to mind at the moment.
When students are have been accused, and there are probationary hearings or civil kinds of hearings that the university's involved in, are you sometimes called on as a kind of a private counsel for those students in those kinds of hearings?
Yeah, I've never been involved formally in any hearing on campus. But I've been involved in quite a few situations where either faculty or administrators have talked to me about a situation, or students have talked to me in preparation to being involved with those, or after the fact. Very much of that, have been in a private counseling kind of settings. But I can't remember of any instance where I was seen as in any kind of official advocacy role or whatever with that.
And the law enforcement agencies, do you sometimes do things?
Oh, yes. Well, there are quite a few instances where the local police department has talked to me about people that they knew that I was involved with, and I told them what I was able to or whatever. The other things is whenever there's a, I know that whenever there's a racial or ethnic slur anywhere, the local police have talked to me about that because they know that I'm my involvement with all of that. But there have been quite a few conversations about things and how it could be helpful.
What about the evolution of guidelines about sexual harassment? Has that been called, were you part of all that?
Not in an official way, but I remember reading over the early drafts of some of the things that were done here, especially with the sexual harassment thing. And I have provided over the years information from my own church and other traditions that have, I've given information, for instance, to Judith Lampkin's office about things that could be incorporated in statements. The churches over the years have come up with some pretty strict, we have a position on everything. You name it, somewhere it's written down, we have a position on it, gun control to abortion to whatever. And so very often the statements themselves are just sort of there, but the work that went into producing those statements produced some pretty good stuff. And so I usually, whenever I find something where a committee has worked really hard on a certain issue, I try to pass that on to them. And I've been really supportive over the years of the Women's Center. I'm so happy that the Women's Center finally is established, has a place. I've been advocating that for a long time, that we need to do some obvious, there are times when you need some obvious symbols, and you need some solid kind of, you need a place, and you need to say loud and clear. Now, there have also been faculty members, there's one faculty member that I'm thinking of at the moment, whenever I go to talk with him, we always are sure that we close the door because there's a lot of yelling that goes on. And he is very sure that my involvement with women's groups and gay groups and black students and anybody else you can think of is, you know, obviously not only the thing that I shouldn't be doing, but nobody should be doing that. So there's a real, there's a lot of resistance around for change or openness and diversity. There are some people, I think the word diversity just scares some people so bad. And the whole thing that we've been going through about political correctness and all that sort of thing, I think that this is all wonderful. We just need to have lots of conversations. We need to have lots of confrontations in a way that are helpful, because there's so many things we need to talk about. I mean, and a university campus is a wonderful place to talk about them. We have a wonderful example. I work with two institutions that are sexist and racist, but who say we don't want to be, work very hard in some ways not to be, have very good folks trying not to be, but we still end up as institutions oppressing people simply because things get institutionalized. Now, we have to address those issues, and I think not just to be doing it, not just fun for this 1960s ecumeniac to be doing this, but we have to address those issues. And institutionalized sexism and racism is something that this institution has got to be constantly dealing with. And I think that we have a long way to go, but I'm really pleased with some obvious things that have happened here over the last few years. First of all, we can't put everything on our president to do or not to do, but it's extremely important for the person in charge to say out loud, this is not tolerated here, this is the way we do things. The last couple of years at orientation sessions, it has been really clear to people who come to those, both orientation sessions and the students who come to that inquiry kind of thing during the year. It's very clear to them that we're saying out loud here, we have certain policies and guidelines, and we're not going to put up with racist and sexist kind of thing. So I think that's positive, but we just need to keep working at it. If you ask me what I think are the most important, the most serious problems with our institutions, I think that's it. I think we have such ingrained, it doesn't make any difference at this moment that we can point to all kinds of successes. There are more women doing this and more minorities doing that. Well, that's important. But I think we have to understand the kind of history we have and how far we have to go. I work very closely with Dwight Greer in the Minority Affairs Office. But I've said to him, and I've said to the president, I've said to other people, that in a way, the establishment of the Minority Affairs Office is an example of institutionalized racism. And we have to deal with it. I'm happy that it's there. I'm happy we have a room called Cultural Center. But whenever you establish an office and underfund it, and you hire a person who becomes the lightning rod for both the white and the black community, and you say, and then by inference at least, you say, now these are problems that you need to take care of, then that's an example, in my mind, of part of institutionalized racism. Because until we understand that we have to have a transformation across the entire curriculum, and every faculty member has the obligation, it seems to me, to deal with racism and sexism, and that until the curriculum is dealt with, until faculty deal with this, and until administrators deal with it, hiring a person saying they're in charge of minority affairs is only a very, very small first step. And I think in some ways we can do that and feel good that we've done something and then sort of let that go. And then we don't sit back and watch what happens to, for instance, to that person or to that office. Obviously, there are people in the white community who feel uneasy about it, and there are people in the African-American community who feel either he's doing too much or not enough, or should be calling on them to do whatever. So the more that we can have this as a constant conversation, and especially in an academic atmosphere, the better, it seems to me. And so the establishment of Women's Center, the obvious support through money and other kinds of way, office space of groups of gay students or whatever. Now there comes a time when all of this has to dawn on us that these are things that we can't anymore just assume we're going to maybe take care of, or that we can go on with business as usual. All we have to do is look at what's going to happen in the next 10 to 15, 20 years about who's going to be minority and who's going to be majority and this sort of thing, and to train people. I was asked not long ago to speak in a Parks and Recreations class to students who are going to be park rangers and other kinds of relating to public about minority persons and how to deal, you know, that sort of thing. And my assumption to them was that if you are not actively at this moment training yourself to deal in a multicultural world, multiracial world, for 2015 when you're going to be starting out and, you know, working as some supervisor, if you're not intentionally dealing with that right now, you're not being educated for the 21st century. That's where I start with. So it's a bare minimum that our classes, that we ought to be doing more multicultural kind of education. There's hardly any course on this campus that couldn't incorporate something about diversity in it. I don't care if it's quantum physics or what. There are ways, even if it's the attitude of the faculty member, you know, changing. So I have some very strong feelings about all of that, and I know at the same time that I participate in it. You know, the longer that the Protestant campus minister here is a white, male, heterosexual, the longer that what everything I say, you know, I'm a living proof that what we offer the world through whether it's the church or the university, is the result of if I'm not followed by a black woman, maybe what I say, that's an overstatement perhaps, but all I'm saying is that we don't have to look far to see the results of institutionalized racism. We don't have to beat ourselves over the head about it, but we need to say, this, at this moment, the waning moments of the 20th century, that's what we have, and we have it here at Slippery Rock as much as anywhere else.
I did a course once called Black Rhetoric, and our opening question, the opening talk that everyone made, is what kind of racist am I? And it was really a rich, this was in Terre Haute, Indiana, and racism was flourishing, and probably still is.
Yeah.
You know, the color line, it's kind of sociological color line, just so blatant. And we created all kinds of stirs over that question. And we had confrontations, and we had deans descending on us to say, what in the world are you doing in that classroom? Mm-hmm. And all kinds of, you know. But it is a good fundamental question, you know. And a little soul searching has to come somewhere, and maybe that's it.
Well, right after the cross-burning incident, and when we formed the group, African-American students and others of us were flooded with mail from white supremacist groups in Pennsylvania. And there's a group, I got some information not long ago about that they documented from the middle of 1990 until end of 91, I think it was, the activities of identifiable white supremacist groups in Western Pennsylvania. And there were just numerous, not only numerous groups, but activities ranging all the way from rallies to articles to petitions and that sort of thing. So there is no way anymore to talk about a part of the country or whatever, but we just need to deal with that. Now, as I said a while ago, we don't need to, you know, beat ourselves over the head with this, but we do, I think, need to confront it openly, and the university is one of those places that, that can really be doing it. We could be changing our language. For instance, the university is a wonderful place. My son just finished seminary. Now, when he wrote a paper in seminary, it was unacceptable for him to write in male-specific language. People are coming out of our seminaries these days are trained to use inclusive language. And if you ever hear me pray and I use male-specific language, you'll know I've just made a mistake, and I know it, you know, because in all of our new worship literature, is all of our services are intentionally inclusive, because the way we talk about each other and the way we talk to each other has a lot to do with the way we treat each other. So the university is one of those places. Now, you see, I'm able to say that very often in different kind of settings, and be involved in some spirited dialogue about that. So that's why, to me, being on a campus is so exciting, and why it's kind of scary that I might not be here next year or the year after, not because I won't find another campus to do it, but, you know, I don't want to start over someplace and, you know, getting to know people again. It takes so long to establish those kind of relationships.
You get the doors open, then you know what.
Yes.
I'm curious I taught here 18 years, and I stayed away from the faculty lounge after a certain period of time because of the gossip and scuttlebutt and all of that kind of stuff, and had a lot of problems with privileged communications. And I wonder, and I know you live in a world of privileged communications, and how do you sort that out? How do you keep the privileged stuff private? And
it's very, very difficult, simply because you're constantly running into situations where, you know, a person's well-being might well depend on you getting close to violating that, especially if it comes to physical or mental situations, students or faculty or others that you're involved with, conversations about suicide or violent kind of behaviors. It's a very, very, and I just, I just hope that, you know, that every situation that I do the most loving thing. But I'm very conscious of that, obviously. When someone comes to me to talk, or, you know, counseling or whatever, I assume from the very start that this is privileged communication, and I find out later on whether it really is or not. I'm very, very careful not to, you know, try not to violate that, because you're right. There's hardly any place anywhere you can go anymore to feel secure and knowing that it's not going to come back to haunt you one day, or for political reasons or whatever. I know that over the years it's been very obvious to me that there are some faculty members who have talked to me about situations that they really should have been talking, or I hopefully could have been talking to someone else about in their department or where else, but because, you know, later, what's going to happen later on down the line, it's not possible for them to talk to anybody except somebody they saw was fairly neutral, at least had a reputation for not doing that. But that is tough.
I mean, you have to sort out hallucinations there,
yeah,
or, you know, paranoia, because some people have got an eternal problem. You know, they thrive on them, and treating some of those things seriously gets tricky, I suppose.
Well, one of the things that I've always, you know, tried to do is to treat every individual and every person seriously and with dignity. And when you do that, and I think then when you sort through things and say, you know, what's the most loving thing how's the most loving way that I can help this person? Then you have to do what you think, you know, what you think is right. And you never know. And I think, I know a lot of people take their work home with them all the time, but, you know, mine is never anywhere but with me. And some of it is very, on the one hand, I enjoy counseling. And I'm not sure I could have said that a few years ago, but I, you know, on one level, kind of I do. But on the other level, it's a very draining thing, I'm tired after a while of doing it, and just very really need a break. But I think that if I looked at my week, for instance, in a way of a time study kind of thing, maybe 40% of my time would be spent what I would consider counseling. Some of it's very formal. A lot of it is just a one-time conversation. Health services and other places. So, but that sort of makes what I do at this point just so exciting that I can't imagine doing anything else. I don't know of anything that I do during the year outside of writing a report at the end of the summer and a couple of other minor things that I don't like to do. You know, what I do is I just very much enjoy everything that I do, and because I'm able to have a lot of freedom to do what I do best and to stay away from some of the things I don't do well, then I can't imagine doing anything else that'd be more satisfying. That's why it's so frustrating at this point for me to get the feeling that financially we might not be able to continue, and that's just my honest kind of reaction to that. But I am so happy that the universities still are an inviting place for people to do ministry and higher education, and I'm aware that I owe the university honesty and integrity, and I need to keep current. I need to work hard at being a professional person, and I need to be honest in what I do, and they need to know that I'm not a sectarian person, that I'm not here to drum up any kind of business for the Methodist Church or any other church, and I know that's in the back of, I understand all the time that when I meet somebody new, go into a new venture, that there's a trust relationship that needs to be established from the beginning, and it doesn't bother me. But I know it's there all the time. But fortunately, I've been here long enough at Slippery Rock that I start to know what it means to feel. People say, sort of part of the woodwork. I'm only 13 years. I'm not really part of the woodwork yet, but I'm starting to fade into the upholstery a bit.
Well, I think you should know. I think you do know that of all the people on this campus over a period of time, you're the one that people respect the most. You're not in the woodwork. You're a really positive influence and trusted. You mentioned some people you have worked with. Father Ted was one. Are there others, or can you tell more about Father Ted? People who have helped you, people that you respect, have helped your programs?
Yes, a couple more words about Ted Rutkowski. As I said, we didn't know each other, of course, before coming here. But we had a couple of conversations on the telephone before I arrived, and we had a mutual friend on the national level and that sort of thing. So we had a commitment from the beginning to try to work as a staff. But, of course, what happened was the icing on the cake is we became just really good friends. And we were able to have honest conversations about things, disagreements about things, but still really be close friends. And Sister Rosaire Kopchinski, who came at the same time, is a Franciscan sister, and right out of higher education program of her own, the three of us, it was like we worked so well together immediately that it was just wonderful you know, whenever you go to a new place, you're always, you know, a lot of anxiety. And the three of us just really worked together very well. And the person who followed him has become a really good friend of mine, Father Kleppner, Joe Kleppner. At the beginning of our relationship, we found out that we were in different political parties. We had different opinions on almost everything. We decided this was a great opportunity to carry on a Protestant-Catholic dialogue on a daily basis, because also very quickly we came to the conclusion that we really did like each other. And so every day for the 5 years he was here, we had the opportunity to carry on that conversation, and we still do from a distance now. We carry on that conversation. The person that really stands out in my mind is Sister Conchetta Fabo, who is also a Franciscan, was here for just 1 year. But she had experience in training Peace Corps people who were going to be going to Central America. She was training them in Spanish. She was fluent in Spanish. And Sister Conchetta has this wonderful way of relating the peaceful life of a Franciscan to activism. You know, she was able to come across as this anti-war pacifist kind of peaceful, but you know, in a non-confrontation, she lived. You know, a lot of us would, you know, I'm a pacifist, and if you don't agree with me, you know, you're in trouble or something. But Sister Conchetta taught me so much about this peaceful living that I, you know, she really stands out in my mind. And a lot of faculty people here have just been really significant for me. I've done, a couple of years ago, Bob Crane and I did a series for a Presbyterian church in Butler on the liturgical year. And I did the history of the liturgical year, and he did art to show, you know, through the centuries, Christian art that had pertained to all of that. And Ted Knoiper, we've done some very, a lot of interesting things. I also had his wedding and baptized both of his children. So that's the kind of thing also that when you look back and see the pictures on the wall of the marriages and the baptisms and not only of faculty and others, but of students, those are the kinds of things that really stand out in your mind, I think. And John Peterson, who's a pastor of the Presbyterian Church here, we always look to him as the sort of walking historian, because he's been here for 27 or 28 years, and whenever we say, when did that start, he'll tell you when it started and who helped start it and that sort of thing. But beyond all of that, he's just been a good friend and pastor. But I think those are the people that really stand out in my mind, and I'm sure if I thought for a while, there'd be a whole lot more. The kind of experiences that I think that I've had at Slippery Rock are, they're the kind of things that I think when I was in Nebraska, it was a positive experience in Nebraska, but I was always thinking, this would be like, if I really was doing what I really wanted to do, this would be like it would be. And when I came to Slippery Rock, I kept I'm pinching myself. They say that this is what they want to do, and we really are doing it. And I think the kind of witness that makes to the community, where you work together, and it's obvious that you're open to persons from other traditions than your own, and that what you're really there for is to be involved in this wonderful enterprise of higher education from your own point of view, then I think that makes it very exciting.
Are you on the Town Gown Committee, or whatever it's called?
Well, the Town Gown Committee recently voted to end its existence, at least in the way it's been going. But yes, from the very beginning, I was a part of it. The last couple of years, I've not been as active. But when I came here, that was one of the things that I got involved with right away. And I was on that. They had also, for several years, the executive council of that, which met separately from the Town Gown organization. It was the president of the university, the mayor, the borough, the chief of police, and four or five others, and I was involved with that too. We're able to deal with some things that you had to deal with in a more confidential way. I think the Town Gown organization, you know, is a good example of community working together. And I think it's just one of those things that's going to take a new configuration in a couple of years. But at the last meeting I attended, I think that was the vote to at least go out of existence the way it's composed right now and to sort of reform maybe in the fall. It seems to me that whenever we can help community be formed, especially right now, that's a great gift, because I think a lot of people don't feel part of community. You know, feel, you know, the alienation a lot of individuals I think feels because we don't feel too much part of community. And I'm not sure who's at fault there or what all the reasons are or what really is to be done about it. But I think that when we look back on the 80s and the 90s, I think that's probably going to be what I think we'll look at. The people were really struggling to figure out, how am I part of this community anymore? Or am I part of the community anymore? Or my community's gone and left me? Or, you know, we're so mobile and things change so fast. And
do you have a relationship with the fraternity and sorority situation on the?
Not in any kind of official way. I would never be an advisor to a fraternity or a sorority. I've done some programs with them occasionally. They've asked me to come and talk to them about various things, anything, you know. But there's been no official relationship.
I was going to change direction completely, and since we're doing history, we didn't really get any early history of P.A. Harmon, only that you're from the South. And how, can you give us a little bit of that background?
What kind of a rebel are you?
Well, born in the Shenandoah Valley of Virginia. When you're born in Virginia and in the Shenandoah Valley, it's very clear to you early what you are and what life is all about. That your, you know, history is dripping off of everything. From one of my cousin's houses, you could see about four Civil War battlefields without doing anything but turning your head. So I'm from the Shenandoah Valley of Virginia, and I grew up in a family. My grandfather owned a construction company. It was very clear early on that I was going to be involved in the construction company business. So I enrolled at Virginia Tech in architectural engineering. And before I even started my first class, I realized I don't like construction work. I can't stand digging holes for my grandfather. And I love seeing this church built, all this stuff, but that's not my world. So I decided to change. So even before I started my first day of class, I switched curriculums at Virginia Tech, and I went into pre-law. Pre-law, I think they were calling it, what do they call it in those days? It wasn't a pre-law course, but anyway, that's what I was. I was headed for law school. And during the time in college, I met a man who was teaching world religions. I took a course with him in world religions to fill up a hole in the curriculum, and took a course in great traditions and ethics. And I was in his office one day, and I looked up on the wall and saw that he had gone to seminary, and then that he had gone on to graduate school, got his PhD. And I raised this question, what are you doing? You're a minister. He said, yeah. I said, I didn't know you were a minister. He said, well, this is what I do as a minister. I teach religion in college, and that's my calling. And that occurred to me such an intriguing thing, and I've been thinking for so long. I mean, I've always been part of my faith tradition, been always very important to me. Lutheran, Methodist. Father was Methodist, mother was Lutheran. Went to both churches all the time. And all of a sudden it dawned on me that that was something that, you know, could be important in my life. When I finished with college, I went to worked for 2 years with an insurance company handling claims, trying to figure out if I was going to law school or seminary or what. Got to handle malpractice claims, and it was wonderful for 2 years. And then went to seminary in 65. By this time I was married, and we had two sons. Timothy, the youngest son, is a claim representative working for an insurance company. And my oldest son graduated from here in 65 with a double major in English and history. And through a couple of other kinds of things that he did, ended up 3 years ago going to seminary. When he reads this, if he reads this, this will be the first time that I have said this publicly, but I think one of the main reasons he did that was because of his relationship with Bob McCoskey. He and Bob were very close. From the very first day, Paul was a student here. And Paul worked in the Altar Project from its, you know, from the time he got here and all that sort of thing. And it wasn't but about 6 months after Bob died that Paul told us that he had been accepted to 3 seminaries and was getting ready to choose one. And I think that, you know, a very significant person in his life. And so I've been married 30 couple of years. My wife is a dental assistant for Dr. Duryea here in town. And so the world of higher education since I was 17 has been it, you know, except for those couple of years I worked with an insurance company. So like a lot of other people that I relate to around here, we think this is the best of all worlds. And so when I think about my calling as clergy and as a minister, there is no other, you know, there isn't anything else at this point that I want to do. That has not always been real comfortable because there aren't that many of us who do the kind of specialized work. And so most clergy that I relate to are parish ministers, and sometimes we don't, you know, we're not always having the same conversation that we think we're having. But it has been just really positive, and although I'm not thinking actively about retirement, obviously I'm going to retire, and hopefully I make it that long. And I want to go back to the South, to the Southeast. I love Atlanta. Of all the places we've ever lived, I'd go back to Atlanta in a heartbeat. But the South, when I talk to colleagues who are campus ministers in North Carolina, Virginia, Georgia, there's so much excitement. When we talk about dealing with racial issues, our colleagues in the South, both black and white, they're so much more actively involved than we are here. There's so much more going on. There's so much more opportunity and more openness to deal with that. Talking to a recent African-American woman who's just come on the staff here. She just moved from University of North Carolina in Greensboro as a student, and talking about she already has felt there's just much more excitement and activity there when it comes to interracial things than there is here, both in the black community and the white community. So there's a lot of things that I feel very positive about being a Southerner, and I feel very, very positive about one day going back there.
I think that's a lovely benediction. Is there anything else you'd particularly like to cover?
I don't think so. I just really enjoyed the opportunity to, like I said in the beginning, I think, to work where the two institutions that I love the most meet every day. It's been good. Thank you for asking.
These conversations don't have a formal end, so we get a chance to think about more we'd like to hear, or if you think of other things that we should know, then we'd like to continue. The tapes and the transcripts stay in the archives and are secure. We haven't decided yet how we will publicize them or how they will be used, but we hope they'll be an important resource.
Mm.
Really.
Thanks.
Good to have you part of it.
Thank you.